musical chanting, but we made an attempt. Of course, Krishna is looking at our, not at our musical expertise, but he looks at our feeling. So if we chant the prayers of the great Vaishnavas with feeling, then there is great benefit. Prayers are very, very important for devotees. We are discussing Queen Kunti's prayers. So we need to discuss, before we start the verses proper, why prayers are important, why we need to discuss prayer, and why Queen Kunti is important. And therefore why Queen Kunti's prayers are important. Right? Often when we read Srimad Bhagavatam or other books, devotees tend to skip the part that deals with long prayers. Isn't it? In Krishna book, how many devotees have actually read the prayers of the personified Vedas? Or the prayers by the demigods to Krishna in the womb of Devaki? Or the prayers of Akrura? So many wonderful prayers containing the highest philosophical truths and which are chanted with so much devotion are to be found in our scriptures. But generally, because prayers seem to be a little dull in the sense there's no action going on, so we tend to skip it a little bit. But for our devotional progress, it is very, very important that we study these prayers very, very carefully. There are many, many great prayers in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Can you name some of them, the great prayers of the Bhagavatam? I mentioned some. Prayers by Lord Shiva. Do you know what it is called? What are the prayers by Lord Shiva in the Srimad Bhagavatam called? The Rudra Geet. Very famous. And he taught it to whom? He taught this prayer to the Prachetas, the 10 sons of King Prachina Bahishat. Any other famous prayers? Gopi Geet. How can we forget the Gopis of Vrindavan? Their prayers. At various times they have offered various prayers. In particular, the Gopi Geet is very famous. The Venu Geet, chapter 21, that is also very famous. So many prayers are offered by the Gopis all through the 10th canto. Any other prayers? Akrura's prayers, yes. Akrura is very famous for his prayers. In fact, he is considered to be the perfection in offering prayers, Vandanam. And then Uddhava's prayers. There are so many such prayers. Dhruva Maharaj has offered prayers. Prahlad Maharaj, like that. So we should study all these prayers very, very carefully. So the question therefore arises, why? Why should we study these prayers? Number one, because it is an essential limb of the process of bhakti. Shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu smaranam, padasevanam, archanam, vandanam, dasyam, sakhyam, atmanivedanam, iti punsarpita vishnu bhaktis chen navalakshana. So the nine limbs or symptoms of bhakti, among them vandanam or prayers, are one of them. So we are expected to follow at least one of these limbs and attain perfection. In history, there are examples of great devotees who have practiced one of these limbs and perfected their lives. That doesn't mean that they didn't do the other things, but they predominantly did one of these things. Who perfected his life by the process of Shravanam? Parikshit Maharaj. Who perfected his life by Kirtanam? Shukadev Goswami. Who perfected his life by Smaranam, remembering? Prahlad Maharaj. Who perfected life by Padasevanam? Lakshmi Devi. Who perfected life by Archanam? Prithu Maharaj, Archana means the process of deity worship. Prithu Maharaj, and by Vandanam, offering prayers, Akrura. By Dasyam, Hanuman. Sakhyam, Arjuna. Atma Nivedanam, Bali Maharaj. And all the nine, Ambarish Maharaj. So in this way we see that if someone, Akrur, someone like Akrur, just by offering beautiful prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he perfected his life. It is not that we are expected to do only prayers. Our principal process in Kali Yuga is Shravanam Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam. But nevertheless, all the other limbs of bhakti are also very important for us, because they help us in remembering Krishna, which is the ultimate goal of our life. To always remember Krishna with love and devotion. Always forget Krishna, never. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. So this is the sum and substance of following all regulative principles. So we must follow the process of Vandanam, because it is a very devotional act if done properly. And it enhances our bhakti. You will find many times when you go to the famous temples in India, if you look next to you, you may find someone who is offering all kinds of stotras and stutis and prayers. This is culture. So therefore we should also learn the art of offering prayers. In fact, one of the 64 principles of devotional service, as outlined by Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion, is that one must offer prayers to the Lord. It is not one may offer. If we read, it is one must. That means it is an imperative. Devotees must learn to offer prayers. Rupa Goswami also says in another regulative principle that when one comes to the deity of the Lord, one must beg for his mercy. Many times devotees ask, when we come in front of the Lord, what do we do? So we should, of course, look at the beautiful forms of their lordships. We should beg for their mercy. And we should offer prayers. Whatever prayers we know. If we know some wonderful prayers, that's fine. Otherwise, we may simply chant Hare Krishna mantra. Because Hare Krishna is also a prayer. It is a prayer for deliverance. It is a prayer for eternal service at the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. In the Narasimha Purana, it is said that one who comes in front of the deities and very feelingly and devotionally offers prayers to the Lord, he immediately becomes freed from all sinful reactions and is very quickly promoted to Vaikuntha Loka. So these are the benefits when we chant prayers for the Lord. Another reason why we can chant or learn to chant prayers is it can save us in times of trouble. Padam padam yad vipadam natesham. This world is always full of trouble at every step. The story of Gajendra comes to mind. Gajendra was the king of the elephants, and he was caught in a duel with a crocodile, and the battle continued for how many years? 1,000 long years. And the battle went on and on, but because the crocodile is an animal of the water, he was getting stronger day by day. Gajendra, being an elephant, an animal of the land, became weaker. And in a moment of desperation, he realized that none of his family members, his queens, his sons, his bodyguards were able to help him. All the other people of this world, our family members, our doctors, our lawyers, our policemen, they're all fallible soldiers. Fallible soldiers means they cannot help you when you really need them. At the time of death, who can help us? No one. So Gajendra realized this fact, And then desperately, he began to offer prayers to the Supreme Lord. So the question may be asked that how could an elephant speak prayers? Because in his previous life, he was a great king, Indradumna. And he had somehow or the other offended Agastya Rishi. And Agastya Rishi had cursed him to become an elephant. But also because he was a great devotee in that life, by Krishna's mercy, he was able to remember those prayers. They came to him in times of need. And therefore, in that moment of crisis, the most difficult crisis that can ever come in a life is at the point of death. So that point of impending death, he cried out to Krishna and chanted those beautiful prayers. And then Vishnu was sitting in Vaikuntha. He said, "Oh, my devotee is offering prayers." He got astride Garuda. Immediately he came down without delay. And with a Sudarshan Chakra, cut off the head of the crocodile and delivered Gajendra. So for us also, Prabhupada explains, we have to practice chanting the holy name and these wonderful prayers, because we never know when death will come. And when death comes, we should be prepared. If we have not practiced throughout our life, all of a sudden at the point of death, we are not going to be able to recollect the Hare Krishna mantra or the other prayers. There was one devotee who was preaching to another man who was practicing Ashtanga Yoga. And they were traveling, they were friends. And they were traveling in a car together. They were going from one city to another city, I think from Bombay to Pune. And on the highway, this discussion was going on. The devotee was trying to explain how we must learn to chant the holy name, and that is the perfection of all spirituality, that is the highest yoga. And the other man was explaining while driving, that no, yoga, which asana did you practice now? At the time of death, you can't think of Bhujangasana and whatever, any other asana. But you can chant the holy name, or you can try to remember the wonderful prayers offered by the great devotees to Krishna. So by practicing like this, like Gajendra did, then at the time of crisis, the greatest moment of crisis and death, we will be able to remember. And we will be able to tide over this period of death and go back home, back to Godhead. Another reason why we can offer prayers is that it pleases Krishna. Krishna is pleased when he is glorified. We are also pleased when we are glorified. But our pleasure is based upon bodily false ego. Krishna's pleasure is not based upon bodily false ego. It is true ego. Sometimes people get envious. Why does Krishna demand that we should respect him and honor him? That's ego. Because if we do that, then that person is considered egoistic. But when Krishna does it, it is pure ego. It is reality. When we expect praise for ourselves, it is falsehood. But when praise is given to Krishna, it is reality. It is due to him. It is explained in the Skanda Puran that a person whose tongue is always decorated with wonderful prayers offered to the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna, he draws the respect of all the great saintly persons, the rishis, the munis and so on, and he becomes worshipable even for the demigods. Now, there are so many people we know who worship demigods, right? In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna has called them less intelligent, alpamedhasam. So there are many people of less intelligence who worship the demigods. But the demigods themselves worship the devotee of Lord Krishna whose tongue is always decorated with the chanting of the holy name and by the chanting of these wonderful prayers. So just see that even the demigods are pleased. Many times when people come to Krishna consciousness, they ask, "Oh, I have been worshipping Durga or Ganesh or such and such demigod or goddess for the last 35 years. Now if I come to Krishna and leave the worship of this demigod, will they not get angry with me? Then will I not come into trouble?" The answer is no. If you leave them, in a sense, you don't really leave them. But if you stop their worship and surrender to Krishna, and then that person's tongue is also decorated with prayers and the holy name, then the demigods that they were worshipping will be pleased, not angry. This is the version of the Shastra. So you can show them the Skanda Purana and say, "Yes, see here, the Shastra says like that." So what kind of prayer should we chant? Should we concoct our prayers? In the market there are so many bhajan cassettes available by so many commercial singers. They have written their own bhajans. Should we chant those bhajans or those prayers? No. We should chant the authorized prayers coming in parampara, recognized by the parampara, like the prayers of the great devotees. In the same 64 regulative principles of devotional service of Rupa Goswami, the nectar of devotion, he adds another point that not only should one offer prayers, in a separate point he says, one should offer notable prayers. See how careful he has worded. Notable prayers mean authorized prayers. Prayers offered by the great devotees to Krishna. Not just concocted by anyone. So what are the qualifications of a prayer to be authorized? It must be there in the Shastra. It must have been recognized and okayed by the great acharyas, by the parampara. Then it becomes an authorized thing. And what are the benefits of learning, reciting, remembering such authorized prayers? There are many, many benefits. The first one is that one cannot reach Krishna directly. We talked about the Rudra Gita some time back, the prayers of Lord Shiva. So in his purports in this passage, Srila Prabhupada mentions that one can, of course, pray to Krishna directly. One can offer one's own prayers directly. One can do that. But he says it is better to follow in the footsteps of great souls like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva and so on, and offer the prayers that they have composed. Because our philosophy is all a matter of following in the footsteps of the Mahajans. We don't bypass the Acharyas and go straight to Krishna. Our philosophy is of servant of the servant of the servant. Therefore we should try to learn whatever they have composed and then offer that lovingly to Krishna. Then Krishna is pleased. The second reason we can offer these notable prayers of the great devotees is that these prayers contain a wealth of knowledge. They contain the deepest philosophical truths. They come straight from the hearts of these great devotees who have composed the prayers. How does one understand the absolute truth? The absolute truth cannot be understood by arguments. Tarka apratishtaha shrutayo vibhinna nasa vrishir yasya matam na bhinnam. Neither by simply studying various Upanishads and Vedas, etc., can you understand. There are many munis who will simply argue and quarrel amongst themselves about different points of philosophy. But that is not the way to understand the absolute truth. What is the way to understand? Dharmasya tattvam nihitam guhayam. The most intricate truths of dharma, of the absolute truth, are hidden in the hearts of the great devotees. Therefore, mahajano yena gatah sapantha. Therefore, one must follow in the footsteps of the great Mahajans, the great persons. By doing so, one gets to see what is going on in their hearts.
So what are the prayers of the great devotees? It is nothing but a revelation of what is going on within their heart. So to speak, it is as if you had a periscope to look into their hearts. Nowadays, surgeons and doctors, they have so many instruments to look inside your body. Nowadays, they don't have to cut you up to see everything. Nowadays, with technology, they just put some instruments that have an eye. And then they can see and they can understand what's happening inside your body. So imagine that you had a transcendental periscope or some endoscope or whatever they call it. And you would put in the heart and see what feelings of devotion are going on in the great devotees' hearts. The prayers composed by the great devotees are like that. It's like a periscope that enables you to have a peep into the heart of the great devotees. What kind of devotional feelings are moving around? What kind of devotional realizations of the absolute truth are residing in that heart? So this is the shortcut, the easy way to understand the absolute truth. Not simply by our own effort, but we follow in the footsteps of the great acharyas and obtain their mercy. So this is another benefit of following the prescribed acharyas' prayers, etc. We see it in the prayers of Dhruva Maharaj. When the Lord appeared before Dhruva, he was stunned in ecstasy. His hair stood on end, tears started flowing from his eyes, so much so that he couldn't even see. And all the ecstatic symptoms began to manifest in his body. And he was speechless. He wanted to speak something. He wanted to offer prayers, but he just couldn't speak a word. And he was a 5-year-old boy. What kind of prayers could he have offered? Now all of you have seen 5-year-old boys. Have you seen them offering all kinds of learned and exquisite poetry to the Lord? They can offer at the most of nursery rhymes. But here Dhruva Maharaj was speechless. So what did the Lord do? He took his conch shell and he touched it to Dhruva's head. And when he touched it to Dhruva's head, there came gushing forth, like the Ganga comes from Gomukh, there came gushing forth the most beautiful, eloquent prayers. In the choicest poetry, the choicest use of words, containing the highest absolute truth. In normal course, Dhruva Maharaj would have been unable to speak like this. But because he was touched by the Lord, he was under the shelter of the Daivi Prakriti, Mahatmanastu Maam Partha Daivim Prakriti Mashritaha. Therefore, these wonderful prayers came forth from him. And Prabhupada explains that this is because of the spiritual energy. These prayers are products of the spiritual energy. Prayers composed by those who are not genuine devotees are products of the material energy. Therefore, they are of no spiritual value to us. But prayers like those of the gopis, Akrura, Dhruva Maharaj, and so on, they come straight from the spiritual stratum. So by chanting these prayers, we understand the truth and we develop love for the Lord ourselves. And finally, one more benefit by learning these notable prayers is we learn ourselves how to offer prayers. What is the standard for offering prayers? For everything there is a standard, isn't it? Whenever we want to do something, we have to go by some reference point, some standard. If I want to learn how to drive, I have to look at a good driver. How does he drive? If I want to play cricket, I have to learn at a good cricketer how he plays cricket. So if I want to know the art of how to pray to the Lord, then I must look at these great souls who have become perfect in the art of offering prayers. Then I can also learn how to offer prayers. So therefore, here we are talking about Queen Kunti's prayers. And because she is an exalted soul, we'll discuss a little about her now. Kunti Charitra. So we just talked about the importance of Vandanam or prayers. And briefly, let's talk something about Kunti. Kunti Devi, Kunti Maharani, because she is such a great devotee of the Lord and she has offered such wonderful prayers here. Kunti
was actually the daughter of King Shurasena, and she was called Pritha at birth. But King Shurasena had a cousin called Kunti Bhoj, who was childless. And therefore, at Kunti Bhoj Maharaj's request, King Shurasena gave his daughter Pritha in adoption to Kunti Bhoj. Therefore, Pritha also became known as Kunti, who is the daughter of Kunti Bhoj. This Kunti Bhoj Maharaj, he fought on the side of the Pandavas in the battle of Kurukshetra. Drishtaketus Chekitanaha Kashi Rajascha Viryavan Purujit Kunti Bhojascha Shaivyascha Narapungavaha. In the first chapter, when the armies are being surveyed, so Purujit Kunti Bhojascha, so Kunti Bhoja was there very much as one of the foremost fighters on the side of the Pandavas. Of course, he was also killed in the battle. So Kunti's father, foster father, was Kunti Bhoj. So Kunti Maharani, being actually the daughter of Shurasena, therefore became the brother of Vasudev, a sister of Vasudev. Because Vasudev was a son of Shurasena also. So Vasudev and Kunti are siblings. And Vasudev's son is Krishna. Therefore Kunti becomes Krishna's aunt, his paternal aunt. So this is the relationship between Kunti and Krishna. When she was just a young girl, a Kumari, Durvasa Muni came to the palace of King Kunti Bhoj, and she served the Muni very nicely. Durvasa Muni, as an Anshavatar of Lord Shiva, he is known to become angry very fast, and also he becomes pleased very fast. So when Kunti, young Kunti, served him very nicely, he became pleased and offered her a boon. He gave her a mantra by chanting which she could invoke the presence of any of the great demigods. And just a young teenage girl, you can imagine, she has such a wonderful thing, she can summon any demigod she likes. Imagine if any young girl of today were to get some power by which she could call some film actor in her presence, come here. So Kunti Maharani, innocent little young girl, and she said, oh, let me test it out, let me see what it is. And one day as she was sitting in her room, and it was just about to be sunrise, and as she looked at the sun, lo and behold, she found herself gifted with some mystic vision. When she saw the sun, she saw not just the globe, but she saw the sun god. And then she said, why not invoke the sun god's presence? So she chanted the mantra given by Durvasa and remembered the sun god. And right there and then the sun god manifested. Vivaswan came in front of her. Yes, I'm in front of you. So she was really taken aback. And the sun god says, your prayer will never go in vain. I shall give you a son. She was shocked. No, I didn't want a son. I was only experimenting. I'm just innocently, I tried just to test the mantra. I didn't mean this. She says, no, I cannot go back without fulfilling my word. You have called me for this reason. And if I go back without fulfilling my word, then I will be the laughing stock of all the devatas. Already, because you are hesitating, all the devas are laughing at me. Therefore, I cannot become the laughing stock. So I must give you a son. He said, no, how is that possible? It would be a great sin for me, and so on. He said, no, we are all devas, so there is no question of sin for you. And then she said, but I am only a maiden, and for a maiden to have a son, she becomes an object of censure, and it becomes a matter of shame in the society. So he said, do not worry. I will see that your maidenhood is preserved. And then by his mystic powers, he awarded her a son. And when the son was born, Kunti was perplexed what to do now. Only one or two of her trusted maidservants knew what had actually happened.
with great sorrow in her heart, she put this child in a wicker basket. And the child was most extraordinary because he had a kavach, a natural kavach or a shield on his body, and he had golden earrings of a certain sort with a duplicate of the sun gods. And with a heavy heart, she took him to the bank of the Ganges and very pitifully crying and pleading with the devatas to look after him, begging forgiveness from the Lord and from the child himself, she let the basket float in the Ganges, and the basket floated down, and another charioteer called Adhirath and his wife Radha, they found the child, they brought him up, and then you know the story. The name of the son, of course, was Karna. Much later, just before the battle of Kurukshetra took place, when Karna was to be one of the chief warriors on the side of the Kauravas, Kunti knew that Karna was the only person apart from Bhishma who could have defeated Arjuna, who could have killed all her sons. So she one day approached Karna in a solitary place, bank of the Ganges, offering prayers. She sat quietly behind him. Karna finished his prayers for 2 hours. You see, this is where they would get that tejas, the kshatriyas, and the brahmanas also. In the Vedic culture, we see how empowered people were. How did they acquire this tremendous power? Because of their prayer, because of their tapasya, because of their spiritual activities. Without tapasya, there can be no power. Nowadays, we just want to have power without tapasya, spiritual tapasya. The kshatriyas are also meant to be doing all these activities. Chanakya says in his Arthashastra that a king should spend at least 4 hours every day for spiritual pursuits out of 24 hours. Then he is qualified to lead the country for the rest of the 20 hours. So this gives him the proper vision, the proper intelligence, it gives him the proper power to do the needful. So anyway, after Karna's prayers were over, he turned back and he was surprised to see Kunti. He said, "My dear worshipable lady, what can I do for you?" She said, "I have come to tell you a secret." And she said, she narrated the whole history and told him that he was her son. Karna was shocked. He didn't know whether to believe, not to believe, but he knew that Kunti Maharani was reputed to be a very truthful and virtuous lady. She would never have lied. But still, as the confusion was going on in his mind, there came a voice from the sky. Surya Dev himself spoke and said, "What Kunti Devi is saying is true. Karna, you indeed are my son." And then that was reaffirmed for Karna. So Kunti asked him that, "You please come on the side of the Pandavas. And you are my eldest son. Yudhishthir and all the Pandavas will accept you, their elder brother, as their superior, and you will rule and they will become your servants. It is your right as the eldest son of the Pandavas." So Karna, he had a very great sense of honor. One of the qualities of a kshatriya is that he has a sense of honor. He said, "I have given my word to Duryodhan. Duryodhan helped me in a moment of crisis." You all remember the story in Mahabharata? At the time when the duel was to take place with Arjuna, then the objection was raised that a kshatriya can fight only with a kshatriya, because the supporters of Arjuna wanted to protect Arjuna from Karna. And so they asked him for his lineage. They said, "You are not a kshatriya." So Duryodhan got up and said, "What does it matter what is one's birth? If one is qualified, then one should be able to fight even with a kshatriya." So then he was asked, "What kingdom does he have? He is not a king." So at that very moment, Duryodhan coronated Karna as the king of Angadesh. He immediately summoned sacred water and coronated him right there and then. And because of this gesture, Karna became so indebted to Duryodhan. He said, "I will never ever desert you. because you have come and rescued my honor in the time when I was being dishonored like this. And many other times, it was Duryodhan who came to Karna's support. So Karna said, I cannot give up Duryodhan, whatever he may be, but he has saved my honor. He has helped me in the times of my crisis. And my dear mother, you gave me up in the time of my crisis. You let me go because you wanted to suit your personal needs. So I cannot do what you say. But he said, all right, I can give you a promise that apart from Arjuna, I will not kill anyone of your sons. But I cannot say that I will not kill Arjuna. Arjuna, I must. It is either Arjuna or me. So you'll still have 5 sons left. So Kunti resigned herself to that. She said, okay, I will have 5, the 4 others, and one either Karna or Arjuna. And so this is how actually Arjuna was saved. And the other sons of Kunti were saved. There were many times when Karna could have killed Bhima and others, but he remembered his vow to his mother and he held himself back. Soon after the initial birth of Karna, she married Pandu in a Swayamvar. King Pandu was a very valiant, powerful king. And at the Swayamvar ceremony, Kunti immediately offered the garland to Pandu and they were married. But very soon after that, Pandu was cursed. And because of that curse, he could not beget any offspring. Pandu was always, although very brave, he was more inclined to country life, living a life of solitude in the hills and forests, being one with nature and engaging in spiritual activities and so on. So he retired with his 2 queens, Kunti and Madri. And there they lived a very idyllic life with the animals and birds in the forests. And as time went on, Pandu realized the need for some sons to continue the race. And somehow or the other, he persuaded Kunti to take shelter of the mantras. Initially, he tried to persuade Kunti to have a son through a qualified Brahmana who was superior than him. And when Kunti objected, she said, no, I cannot do this. He said, we were all conceived in the same way, Vidura, Dhritarashtra and myself, we were also conceived by Vyasadeva. But Kunti refused. She said, I cannot do. And then she revealed, there is an option. This was a well-kept secret by Kunti. And then she informed Pandu about the benediction she had received from Durvasa Muni. Pandu was overjoyed. And then she put it into practice. And Pandu said, please call upon Dharma, the deity of religion. So she called him and he promised, your son shall be very virtuous. And then Yudhishthir Maharaj was born. Then after that, again Pandu requested Kunti for another son, this time through Vayudev, so that the son would be very powerful. And the second son was Bhima, who became extremely powerful and strong. The third time, he wanted someone who would be extremely valiant and powerful in fighting, very skilled. So he asked her to summon Indra. And Indra came. And the son born was Arjuna. After 3 sons were born, after a year, Pandu still requested. And Kunti said, no, no more. And then he requested, because Madri was feeling that my co-queen, she has 3 sons, I have no son. So she approached Pandu. Please tell Kunti Devi to tell me the mantra. And then Kunti Devi told her the mantra. And then she was very intelligent. With 1 mantra, she had 2 sons. She called the Ashwini Kumaras, the physicians of the demigods. And then Nakul and Sahadeva were born. So Kunti Maharani, it was her destiny. She had to stay back to look after the 5 because she was the elder of the 2 queens. And when Pandu died, at that time Madri entered the fire, the funeral fire, and Kunti stayed back. And then from then on she was the one who looked after all the 5 Pandavas. She never discriminated between Nakul Sahadev on one hand and the other three. She treated all the five equally as her own sons. She underwent many, many, many austerities because of the evil conspiracies of Duryodhan and his friends. And much later, after the battle of Kurukshetra was over and time came for her to depart, you all know in the Srimad Bhagavatam there is a story of how Vidur comes to Dhritarashtra one time after the battle is over, and he really chastises, insults Dhritarashtra, his elder brother. He uses harsh words and says, "My dear king, you have all your life tried to usurp the kingdom from Yudhishthir and the other Pandavas. And now, after having committed so many injustices against them, you are living in the same house as them, living at their mercy, just like a dog eats a few crumbs of bread thrown by people here and there. You are living at the mercy of the Pandavas. You have no self-respect, and you are living at this age in the comforts of the palace. You should retire, go to the forest, renounce, and try to perfect your life." Sometimes devotees have to use very harsh language. Sadhu means one who cuts. With sharp words, they cut the knot of material attachment to this world. Material attachment is a great impediment in our spiritual progress. So with his harsh words, which are full of compassion actually, for Dhritarashtra, Dhritarashtra understood, came to his senses, and he departed for the forest. And Gandhari, like the chaste wife that she was, still blindfolded, she followed him and served her husband even as he performed austerities in the forest under the guidance of Vidura. Then Dhritarashtra quit his body, and so did Gandhari. Yudhishthir Maharaj discovered only next day after they had left, and he was informed by Sanjay that in the dead of the night Dhritarashtra and Gandhari had slipped out and no one knew where they were. They went without telling anyone. This is the version of Srimad Bhagavatam. In the Mahabharata, there is one additional thing mentioned, that Kunti Maharani also went with Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, and she accompanied them, and she also left her body like that in the forest without telling anyone, even her sons, her daughter-in-law, her grandson. She didn't tell anyone. This is the way to die according to the Vedic culture, the scriptures. When someone leaves home like this, in this way, as was the custom for the Kshatriyas, they were supposed to leave home without telling anyone. And they were supposed to go to a place where no one knew, where no one could find them. And then they would die unnoticed, unknown. Such a death was considered glorious in the scriptures, in Vedic history. Actually, ever since the time that Krishna left Hastinapur to go back to Dwarka, which is the time of these prayers, the very prayers that we are going to discuss now, the prayers of Queen Kunti. From the very time that she offered these prayers with Krishna leaving Hastinapur, Kunti Maharani changed her life. She was always very devotional anyway, but after this point of Krishna's departure, she became very intense in her meditation and spiritual practices. She developed a total disinterest in worldly affairs and in her family matters. This is an ideal example for how ladies and men should be in their old age. They should not interfere in family matters, business matters. They should become totally detached. And even if they are living in the same house, they should not get involved in family disputes, arguments, matters, property, business. No. They should devote all their time exclusively to hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. If they are fortunate enough to go to a place where there are a lot of devotees so that they can reside there amongst them and die in that association in a holy place, that is the best, it's wonderful. If not, in whatever circumstances they are, they should try to live by constantly absorbing their consciousness in hearing and chanting. When Kunti Maharani was living like this, she also performed many austerities, although living in the palace. She would sleep on the floor, she would eat very frugally, and a time came, it is explained by Vyasadeva in the Mahabharata, that she would eat only once in 30 days. And then when Vidura chastised Dhritarashtra, then they all left. Kunti Maharani also left with him. And she passed away, she left her body. She of course returned to the spiritual world, being such a close associate of hers. So her devotional status is very, very great. She is definitely a pure devotee of the Lord. All those who come in very close contact with the Lord, when the Lord has appeared in this material world to perform pastimes, all who are His close associates acting in various capacities, we should understand them to be eternal associates of the Lord. They are not ordinary living beings. They have come here for the special purpose of assisting the Lord in His pastimes, for increasing the special flavor of His leelas. So Kunti Maharani also is such a great devotee of the Lord. She is in the Vatsalyas, being a parent, like on the status of a parent, because she was the paternal aunt of Krishna. You are all aware that there are five rasas, moods in which one can serve Krishna. There is a Shantaras, the mood of neutrality, where the mood of seva is not much developed. One has a sense of the greatness of the Lord, but one doesn't have a developed sense of seva for the Lord. As one progresses, there is a Dasya Ras, where one relates to the Lord as a servant to the Master. One serves the Lord in servitude. Then higher than that is Sakya, friendship, like the cowherd boys of Vrindavan. There was a mood of equality with Krishna. They never considered Krishna to be their superior or to be God. Always considered Him their equal. Then, higher than that is Vatsalya, where the devotee considers Krishna not his equal, but his inferior, his subordinate. He considers, or she considers, that Krishna is dependent on him or her. And that if he doesn't or she doesn't protect Krishna, then Krishna harm will come to Krishna. So this is the mood of Vatsalya. And then higher than that is Madhurya or Shringar Ras, the mood of loving Krishna as a lover and beloved, as exhibited by the gopis of Vrindavan or the queens of Dwarka. So these are the five rasas. And Queen Kunti is a devotee in the Vatsalya Ras, the mood of loving Krishna in parental affection. In the nectar of devotion, there is a hierarchy that is mentioned of those who are in Vatsalya Ras, the great Vatsalya Ras devotees. It is given in an order of superior importance. Who are the greatest devotees in Vatsalya, and then coming down. The number one slot, like you have the top 10 best cricketers in the world, or top 10 popular, movies of the year or something like that. So the version of the verdict of Nectar of Devotion, the top 10 devotees in the Vatsalya Ras, number one comes to Yashoda, Mother Yashoda. Number two, it's obvious, somebody said it, Nanda Maharaj. Number three, Rohini Devi, the mother of Balaram. Number four, Devaki is lower down. Number four are some of those elderly gopis of Vrindavan whose sons participated in the Brahma Vimohan Leela. You know this pastime of how Brahmaji stole the cowherd boys and calves when Krishna and the cowherd boys had gone to the forest to graze the calves. And Krishna expanded himself to become all the calves and the cowherd boys. And he became a perfect duplicate of every one of them, right down to the way they spoke, the way they acted, their idiosyncrasies, the shape of their nose, and everything, their clothes, He became a perfect duplicate of each and every one of them. And even their mothers could not recognize that this was not their child, but it was actually Krishna who had expanded himself as their child. And then this happened for one complete year. So these gopis, who were the mothers of these children, who were now Krishna, they got the fortune to feed, to look after, to love Krishna directly, just as Mother Yashoda had done. Because they actually had a deep desire to have Krishna as their son. And Krishna fulfilled it through the medium of this wonderful pastime of Brahma Vimohan Leela. So for these elderly gopis, who are the mothers of these cowherd boys, they are considered number 4 on the list. Then number 5 is Devaki. She is number 5. And then after that comes the 15 other queens of Vasudev. Rohini and Devaki were two queens of Vasudev, the major queens. But there were also many others. If you read the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 10th canto, you will see that when Krishna entered the wrestling arena arranged by Kansa with Chanur, Mushtik and others were there, the 15 other queens of Vasudeva also were there. And they developed such an intense parental affection for Krishna that they wished to feed him their milk. And even much later, when Krishna, as the king of Dwarka, went to Kurukshetra during the time of the solar eclipse, and when all the residents of Vrindavan had also come there, and on that occasion also it is mentioned in the Bhagavatam that these queens of Vasudev also exhibited tremendous parental affection for Krishna. And while living in Dwarka also, because Krishna was there, they had this affection. So they are considered very high on the list, number 6. And the number 7 is Kunti Maharani. Number 8 is Vasudev. And number 9 is Sandipani Muni, the teacher, the guru of Krishna and Balaram. So this is the hierarchy of those in the Vatsalya Ras. So Kunti Maharani is at number 7. Which is fairly good. We shouldn't think, oh, only number 7. Like sometimes devotees, they say, we want to be gopi in Vrindavan. We say, someone became a cowherd boy. Oh, cowherd boy. Well, so what do we think? Cowherd boy is not an ordinary thing. Going to Goloka Vrindavan is not a small thing. It's the perfection of our life. So Kunti Maharani is on the exalted platform of Vatsalya Ras at number 7 spot. Number 7 spot. So her prayers definitely, therefore, will be very, very instructive for us. It is explained in the Skanda Puran that there are 3 categories or 3 kinds of prayers that we can offer to God. One kind of prayer is called Dainya Vodhika. Dainya Vodhika means Deen. It comes from the word Deen. Means feeling yourself, feeling oneself very humble, feeling oneself very fallen. One offers prayers to Krishna in that state of humility, feeling oneself no good. Mosama Patita Prabhu Na Paibyar. Narottam Das Thakur said, my dear Lord, you will not find anyone more fallen than me. Or Bhaktivinoda Thakur has prayed, Amar Jivan Sada Paperat Nahi Ko Punyeralisha. This is, my dear Lord, my life is full of all the greatest sins and I have not a trace of piety in my life. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur is feeling, as great exalted Vaishnava in this mood, of Dainya. A feeling of great humility, great smallness, that I am nothing, I am insignificant, I am fallen, I am sinful. Like Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says, that if anyone even utters my name, all his piety will be finished. Of course, that is the way he feels.
The truth is that anyone who remembers Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami's name, his sinful effects will be finished. But he is thinking like this. This is the way great Vaishnavas think. Vaishnavira Kriya Mudra Vidyaha Nabujaya. Very difficult to understand the actions and the words of great Vaishnavas. So this is Dainivodhika. Another kind of, the second kind of prayer that is offered is called Lalasa Mayi. Lalasa means intense greed. Mayi means full of. So those prayers that are offered with intense desire, intense greed for obtaining some perfectional stage in bhakti at the highest platform is called Lalasa Mayi. This is particularly for those who are situated on the highest platform of Krishna consciousness, on the platform of Prema Bhakti, who have reached the position called Swarup Siddhi. Swarup Siddhi means to understand your constitutional position in the spiritual world. What are you in the spiritual world? Are you a cowherd boy? Are you a cow? Are you a gopi? What are you? So when one reaches the Swarupa Siddhi platform, one understands one's constitutional position there. And in that consciousness, one offers these prayers seeking some perfectional stage in one of the four rasas. Not the Shanta rasa, usually. So that is called Lalasa Mai Prarthana. It is a very advanced form of prayer. In our Vaishnava songbook, we have Lalasa Mai Prarthana by Narottam Das Thakur. Yes? Gauranga bolite hobe pulaka sharira hari hari bolite nayane bhavanira. In the Lalasa Mai Prarthana, Narottam Das Thakur is singing, when will that day come when by chanting the name of Gauranga my hairs will stand on end and my body will tremble? When will that day come when by chanting the name of Lord Hari tears will flow down my eyes? An example of Lalasa Mai Prarthana prayer. Or Vishaya Chhadiya Kabe Shuddha Habe Man Tabe Hama Herabo Shri Vrindavan. When will that day come when my mind will be freed of all desires for sense gratification, and then I will be able to Shri Vrindavan Dham in all its purity, in its reality? What we see when we go by buying a ticket to Delhi and then getting off at Mathura and taking rickshaw to Vrindavan, that Vrindavan is the external Vrindavan. The real Vrindavan is to be seen from Divya Chakshu. It is not to be seen only with these eyes. The real Vrindavan can be understood with the eyes of pure devotion. So this is a feelingly offered prayer by Narottam Das Thakur. Similarly, every day in the morning we chant in front of Tulasi Devi, Mora Eya Vilash, Vilas Kunje Diyo Vyas, Nayana Heribo Sada. So we should always strive to see the lotus feet of Radha Krishna. This is our Abhilash. Govinda Das Kaviraj is praying. So these are some examples of prayers called Lalasa Mai. The third category of prayer is called Samprarthanatmika, which means prayers which are offered with great feeling. Feelingly, with great devotion they are offered. Kunti Maharani's prayers could be classified in this category. Of course, there is some degree of overlap. They are not exclusive categories. Something that is in one category, one prayer could easily be called any of these three also. But specifically, we can see that Kunti Maharani has offered these prayers extremely feelingly, with great devotion. Srila Prabhupada used to chant these prayers very often in bhajan form. Very melodiously, very sonorously, very deeply, slowly on his harmonium, he would sit all by himself and chant these prayers. Like sometimes he would chant Brahma Samhita, Shikshashtakam and so on. So Prabhupada has taught us by his personal example how we should do our bhajan sometimes by chanting the Aryas and great devotees. The background to the prayers of Queen Kunti is, of course, then after the battle of Kurukshetra was over, Yudhishthir Maharaj was installed on the throne, and Then Krishna stayed with the Pandavas in Hastinapur for some months, enjoyed the company of the Pandavas, and the time came for him to leave because the Yadus were also feeling separation from Krishna in Dwaraka. When he wanted to leave, Yudhishthira Maharaj begged him, "Please stay." So how could Krishna refuse his pure devotee and friend Yudhishthira? So he stayed back. Again after some time had passed and he prepared to leave again. And at that time, Uttara, who was the wife of Abhimanyu, she came running because Ashwatthama had thrown a Brahmastra to kill her fetus, to kill the child in her womb. You remember the discussions in first canto Bhagavatam, where Ashwatthama already had killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi, and he had been sufficiently punished by Arjuna personally. He had been humiliated by having half his head and half his mustache cut, which is like death practically for a Kshatriya. So still Ashwatthama did not desist. He still threw a second time another Brahmastra. He wanted to finish all those in the dynasty of the Pandavas so that the Pandavas dynasty would end there. When Uttara saw this fearful Brahmastra approaching her, she immediately approached Krishna and begged him to save her. And Krishna understood what had happened. He immediately entered the womb, expanded himself and entered the womb of Uttara and began to circle the fetus, and thus he protected Parikshit. He was called Parikshit later on after he was born, because as a child in the womb, as the four-armed form of the Lord, holding Shankha Chakra Gada Padma, very effulgent, shining like the sun, was circulating fast around him. And this child in the womb was looking. Can you imagine his condition in the womb? And he's seeing this very beautiful, resplendent personality, so attractive, so cooling to the sight. His eyes were riveted on this personality who was smiling very gently with his lotus feet on a lotus and four arms. And he was going round and round and round, and this child was gazing with great awestruck at this form. And when the child came out of the womb, he was still looking. Where is that person I saw? Where is that person I saw? So he was Pariksha. He was examining. Where is that person? Therefore he was called Parikshit. So Krishna entered the womb of Uttara. He saved Uttara and her womb. And after that, he was about to leave. And at this time, this is the occasion when actually Kunti Maharani approaches him. She comes in front of her chariot, of his chariot, and begs him not to go. And that is where, feelingly, when the impending separation is there, when about there is about to be separation, impending separation, that moment is very painful. Not only is separation painful, but impending separation also is very painful. When the gopis, for example, realized that Krishna is about to go, initially they couldn't believe it. But when they saw that Akrura and Krishna and Balaram meant business, that they were actually boarding the chariot and about to go, they all came in front of the chariot, "No, no, 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 you can't go." Their hearts were wrenched with immense pain. So in a similar way, but in a different Vatsalya mood, Kunti Maharani is realizing, after Krishna is leaving us, he is going away, what will happen? And then she is offering these wonderful prayers. Much before the Mahabharata war also, when they were living in Hastinapur and when there was quarrel, always, all the time, with the Kauravas, some or the other conspiracy they were hatching, in the Nectar of Devotion it is said that Queen Kunti mentioned to Akrura, "My dear Akrur, we have not seen our lotus face Mukunda for such a long time. When you see him in Dwarka, please tell him that we are all sitting here helplessly in the midst of our enemy like a doe amongst wolves. When will we be fortunate enough to see him again? Please tell him when you see him that we are longing for the sight of his beautiful lotus face." After the battle of Kurukshetra was over, Kunti Maharani became very grateful to Krishna, because Krishna had given her a promise that he would bring back her five sons alive after the battle. And she became
so grateful, so happy that she blessed Krishna. And she said, in course of time, the sun may become cold and the moon may become hot, but your promise will never fail. So she was so pleased, she offered him the Ashirvad, that Krishna's promise will never fail. And Krishna accepted that most humbly, because she was his superior, she was his aunt like a mother. He accepted. So the devotees are so powerful that they bless even the Lord. And Krishna accepts that blessing as something very, very wonderful. So she accepted. And then she began to offer these most wonderful prayers. They are very simple prayers, yet they are so deep, so profound. They contain all the different philosophical truths. Very, very devotional. So, from tomorrow, we will begin actually discussing the verses. It may not be possible for us to finish in these three sessions the entire prayers to Queen Kunti. But tomorrow evening, and then on Sunday, we will try to finish as many shlokas as are possible, as we can. And then on a subsequent visit, we can finish the remaining verses. So, we will stop here. If there are any questions pertaining to what we have discussed today, then you may feel free to ask, or if you have any comments to make also, I will be happy to hear them. Hare Krishna. Thank you for your kind attention, patient listening. Yes. The question is that Kunti Maharani is a great devotee, but at the beginning of the war she seems to be having some personal desire because she wants her son saved, and she asked Karna to come on their side. Well, you see, they are first of all participating in this Leela. This is a whole drama being enacted. This whole, whenever the Lord descends, he enacts a grand drama that is set on the earth. And all these other eternal associates who come with him are playing their part in the drama. It is meant to be very instructive for humanity. Of course, these devotees don't know that they are playing a drama. They are part of a drama. For them, it's very real. They are there by Yogamaya. So Kunti Maharani is playing the part of a mother. It is very natural for a mother to be attached to her children, her sons, however grown up they may be. You all have experience, even though you may be 40 years old, 50 years old, your mother will still tell you, look left, look right before crossing the road. So this is the natural affection for a mother. She is feeling affection naturally. And secondly, the Pandavas were also great devotees. So her affection is not simply ordinary mundane affection also. It is because they are great Vaishnavas, great devotees of the Lord. And she wants to save Karna too. So she tells Karna, you come and you be the king. So she is being very large hearted. She is not saying that only my other five sons should be. She says, you be the king, they will all be your servants. They will all serve you. You be the king. Actually, Krishna also makes this proposal to Karna later. Soon after Kunti speaks to him, Krishna also calls him aside later and tries to negotiate. He tries to make this proposal, you come on our side. But Karna remains steadfast. He says, no, I will not. Any other point? Yes, Dharmadeva Prabhu. The question is that pertaining to Rupa Goswami's instruction that we should chant notable prayers of the great acharyas, what if we come before the Lord and chant the prayers of the great acharyas, but we don't remember the exact words, but the gist of it we know and we offer that? That is certainly quite fine. Krishna is Bhavagrahi Janardana. He is not Vyakarana Grahi Janardana. How expert you are in the grammar. He is not how much you have remembered the shlokas. He is seeing your mood. And he accepts. If you have got the gist and you are offering that, he is very happy. And also, you can offer in any language. Krishna is a linguist. He knows all languages. We can try, experiment. Speak in any language of the world. Even from some African jungle, some language that they speak, Krishna understands that also. So even if they speak, they offer a prayer, Krishna will understand. So whatever be the language, Krishna will understand. At one time, Srila Prabhupada gave a very interesting analogy. He said, people wonder and ask this question about language in which the prayer is to be offered, like the Hare Krishna mantra or some others. But even if you don't understand the language, of course if you do, it's wonderful. It increases the taste. You can relish the prayer more when you understand the language. But even if you don't, still there is no loss. You will get benefit. Because it is transcendental sound vibration. It will purify the heart. It will give you bhakti. For example, at the time of the monsoon, we hear the thundering of clouds. Now, people speaking diverse languages from diverse cultures, whether in the African jungles, whether in the Himalayas, or whether in America, Russia, they all understand the language. It brings fear in the heart. The loud thundering of the clouds immediately makes everyone's heart twitter. So even though they are of different languages, the message is loud and clear. So same way, we may not understand the language, but the effect is there, it's the same. It will come. So the important thing is that we should offer very feelingly these prayers. So we should practice. And we may offer in English, you may offer in Kannada, you may offer in whatever language you are familiar with. And Krishna will accept. In respect to this, when Krishna was leaving Dwarka to come to Hastinapur, the queens of Dwarka and the other ladies of the palace were offering prayers. And Krishna was extremely pleased. And Prabhupada says in the purport there, now we are talking of residents of Dwarka here. And he was saying that Krishna was more pleased by their prayers, which are very simple language. It was not composed in some fine poetry, and it was just simply some simple words they spoke. He said, Krishna is more pleased by that than by the various hymns and prayers of the Vedas. Because these prayers offered by the residents of the palaces, the ladies of the palace of Dwarka, they were full of devotion. Similarly, Prabhupada explained that, say, Narottam Das Thakur's bhajans, they were written in very simple Bengali language, not very sophisticated Bengali. Very simple Bengali that the average person in Bengal in those days could understand. But they are full of devotion. Therefore, they have great power to deliver us. So it is essentially the heart, the devotion with which we chant these prayers, that is most important. At the same time, if we can, we should try to learn the language, because it will increase the taste. We will get more relish from it. Any other point? Question or comment? Yes. Apparently it was a different Indradumna, wasn't it? Different Indradumna. It wasn't the same Indradumna. It was another Indradumna. Vaishnava Prabhu, correct? From Orissa, so no. It was a different Indradumna. Because the Indradumna Maharaj was associated with Jagannath temple, That history, of course, is a separate history. So it took place at another time in history. The question is that Lalasamayi Prarthana, who said that it is meant for those in the higher perfectional stages, but here it was something like Vishaya Chadiya Kabe Shuddha Abhiman, when will my mind be free of the desire for sense gratification? That doesn't seem like coming from a very high platform. It is, because it is being said by Narottam Das Thakur, who is on the highest platform. His mind doesn't have even a speck of material desire, but he is feeling like that. He wants the perfection of being able to see Vrindavan in reality all the time. That is the perfectional stage, to see the real Vrindavan. Kabe Hama Herabo Shri Vrindavan. So when will my mind become totally cleansed of all desires for sense gratification? And when will I be able to see Vrindavan in reality? We can also chant in that mood. So we can be inspired by that and we can pray to Krishna, please help me to become free of desires. When will that day come? So we can also follow in footsteps of Narottam Das Thakur and pray in similar ways to Krishna. So when we come in front of the deities, a devotee should be trained to know what to do when he comes in front of Krishna. Many times we have so many of these bhajans composed by commercial people. Prabhu Darshan, they want to see Prabhu come in front of them and give them Darshan. They are not qualified. In their personal life, they may be doing all kinds of mundane things. So the question we can ask them is, okay, if the Lord appears before you, what will you do? They will not know what to do. So devotee will know what to do. What do you do when you come in front of the Lord? We offer these prayers very feelingly. We understand. So Krishna is understanding our mood and he reciprocates accordingly. So we could also chant in a similar way.
Suppose you want to study all these prayers, like Queen Kunti and the Rudrajit and all that. What chronology would you suggest we should go about that?
The question is that if we were to study all these wonderful prayers, what chronology would we suggest? We could start anywhere, really there is no problem. But we could start with some of the more basic prayers like Shikshashtakam. It is significant that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this is the only 8 verses he ever left behind in writing. All the others were simply verbally given to his disciples and devotees. But the Shikshashtakam was the only thing he left behind actually in writing. So Shikshashtakam prayers contain the essence of all the Vedas, of all the scriptures. So this is a very, very important prayer for us. Then we could do Brahma Samhita, which is also a standard prayer. Every day in the morning at Shringar Darshan we chant. Thirdly, we could learn the prayers offered in our Vaishnava songbooks. They are also prayers, all these different bhajans. We can also learn the different prayers like that of Queen Kunti and so on. Many, many nice prayers. So these are some of the prayers that we can start with. So shall we have some small kirtan for 5 minutes? Just sitting and...